Hello everyone, my name is Elijah David, minister of the 12th Hour Apostolic Sabbatarian Congregation, Mount Zion, the 12th Hour in Liberty Hill, Texas. Today is May 19, 2014, or the Zip 21, 2018. We will start our first service today with a song entitled, Sunset is Coming, but the Sunrise Will See. Pilgrims for Yahshua and a lowland of sin, hoping that the blessed life crown may win, serving the Master through the morning of eve. Sunset is coming, but the sunrise will see. Sunset is coming, but the sunrise will see. Heavenly beauty makes the shadows to flee. Glory is waiting when the Spirit is free. Sunset is coming, but the sunrise will see. Strangers but happy in his vineyard today, trying to help our young Savior away. Serving the Master through the nighttime or week. Sunset is coming, but the sunrise will see. Sunset is coming, but the sunrise will see. Heavenly beauty makes the shadows to flee. Glory is waiting and the Spirit is free. Sunshine is coming, but the sunrise will see. Weary and footsore ere the battle is won, trusting the promise that we'll hear his will done. Serving the Master all the evening of eve. Sunshine is coming, but the sunrise will see. Sunset is coming, but the sunrise will see. Heavenly beauty makes the shadows to flee. Glory is waiting when the Spirit is free. Sunset is coming, but the sunrise will see.
Man on the White Horse by the Ben Roden, but we are in the track at the 11th Hour Judgment of the Living, the one that he published of V.T. Hollis in 1968. V.T. Hollis published it in 54, I believe, 55, but Ben Roden republished it with some upgrading on it. And so we're just including that in the Man on the White Horse subject. This is part 8. And we're going to take on a little bit where we left off on our last study. We're going to pick up on page 35 with a little review. For the command under the third angel, that's actually for the command with the third angel, in the judgment of the dead period, and the command with the loud cry angel, Revelation 18, with the judgment of the living. It has also been understood and taught by the denomination that the command, thou must prophesy again, is a commission to the Seventh-day Adventist Church. After the disappointment, the thing which the denomination has failed to note is the fact that their commission to prophesy, again, teach is not before all people, nations, tongues, and kings, but before many people and nations and tongues and kings, assuring that the denomination in her present setup is not to finish the gospel work, not to teach all nations, but many. Only a large part of them, whereas the everlasting gospel is proclaimed unto every nation and kindred and tongue and people, Revelation 14:6. Now, I have a new point or two to make here. The denomination was to prophesy again where William Miller left off in 1844, of teaching the second coming of Yahshua and the cleansing and of the sanctuary and the restoring of the sanctuary after the 2300 days. And so they were to really to teach that we were in the judgment of the dead period. And the many people that they were to prophesy and many nations again were where their Adventist membership was at. They were only to prophesy to their own people, the Seventh-day Adventists. That's what the message has always gone, ever since the Adventists have been in existence. Every time there's been any message, a new message is for it, Yahweh always raised up a messenger from our midst, give it to them, and had that messenger take it to them. The Adventists were only supposed to be constantly reforming and reviving their own doctrines and trying to reach sanctification with their three angels' messages. By just by grace, by just believing in righteousness, by faith in present truth, automatically gives them righteousness. And so they were supposed to teach their people this about how to overcome. And so the many people that they were to prophesy again before many nations and so forth was their own people. It wasn't the Gentile people. You don't go prophesying a message to a Gentile people that has already given up the message that you're trying to again repeat. The Protestants coming out of the Dark Ages with William Miller, 50,000 strong, followed William Miller for 10 years. They were out of the Protestant churches. They rejected Seventh-day Adventist truth whenever they had that great disappointment in 1844, and so they're not going to accept the Adventists come and teaching them the same message again in a little different form. They're not going to do that. So the only one that Adventists can prophesy again to is to their own people. As they gain converts in all these nations all over the world over the years, then they were to prophesy to them, their own people. Well, what did Yahshua tell the disciples at the cross after he resurrected and went back to heaven? He says, "Go not unto the way of the Samaritans or the Gentiles, but go ye rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." You only go to your own people with the gospel truth. First, you get your lost sheep first, and then you go to your Gentiles later and get them. But work for the lost in your own midst. And so that's why they were ordered to prophesy again before many people and nations, to their own people. We haven't seen this before, but now we see it, and it's a whole new ballgame. Because those that preach the everlasting gospel is a sanctified, purified church that have come through the five angels' messages. And so they take the fifth angel, the fifth group of laborers, the house of David, the 12th hour, that come out of the Adventist church at the end of the 11th hour, and they take the message, 144,000, and they're a purified church. Now they don't have to take the message to their own brother to teach them how to reach sanctification, because they've already reached sanctification. Now they go and get their brethren, the Gentile brethren from all over the world. Let's continue our reading now. We're on page 36 of this tract, The Man at the 11th Hour, by Ben Roden. It says, "This essential information which the Scriptures give should be taken very seriously, because if we fail to see that before the work goes to completion, there is to be a complete reorganization in the Seventh-day Adventist denomination." There you have it. "We may not pay attention to it, and thus fail to awake from our Laodiceanism, from the stupor of dreaming that we are rich in increase of goods and need of nothing, truth or prophets," Revelation 3:17. "If we awake, though, we will see our true condition, see that we are wretched and miserable and poor and blind and naked, and know it not," verse 17. In fact, only a Laodicean can fail to see right offhand that if the denomination was given only the message of the judgment of the dead, that the message of the judgment of the living is yet to come. Okay, the judgment of the dead is given by the fourth group of laborers, labeled as Seventh-day Adventists, that came to answer the ninth hour call in 1844 to work in the 10th and 11th. But those that are answered the 11th hour call to work in the 12th hour for the judgment of the living. Judgment of the living is that they're working with a purified church, whereas the judgment of the dead, they're not working with a purified church. That's the difference also. It says, and that without it, her dimly burning a lamp will go out, and she will find herself in darkness and without a message for herself or for the world. Isaiah the prophet was shown what will finish the gospel work and what will cause the complete overhauling and reorganizing in the denomination. Here it is. For behold, the Yahshua will come with the fire and with his chariots like a whirlwind, and to render his anger with the fury and his rebuke with the flames of fire. For by the fire and by his sword will the Yahshua plead with all flesh, and the slain of Yahweh shall be many. And I will set a sign among them, and I will send those that escape of them unto the nations, to Tarshish, Pul, and Lud, that draw the bow, to Tubal and Avan, and to the isles afar off that have not heard my fame, nor have seen my glory. And they shall declare my glory among the Gentiles, and they shall bring all your brethren for an offering unto the Yahweh out of all nations, upon horses and in chariots and in litters, and upon mules and upon swift beasts to my holy mountain, Jerusalem, saith Yahweh, as the children of Israel bring an offering in a clean vessel into the house of Yahweh. Isaiah 66:15, 16, 19, and 20. For the purification of the church, you note that this slain of the Yahweh does not come until nations which have not as yet heard of the Elohim, not upon those who are ignorant of him, but upon those who on the one hand think that they are sanctified, and on the other hand indulge in those things which are by the scriptures prohibited for the food. Those that know better are slain, but those who are ignorant of the gospel still live. For this stroke of the Elohim therefore falls upon the disobedient and hypocritical in the church. For those who escape of them, the scripture says, are to be sent not to many, but unto all the nations. And these, the sent ones, are to bring into the house of Yahweh all their brethren, all that are to be saved from the nation. Obviously, then, the slaying takes place after the denomination has prophesied again before many people and nations and tongues and kings. They prophesy to their own people, trying to bring them to sanctification so they won't be destroyed. That's in Revelation 10:11. But before the gospel work is finished, that is, the teaching of the blood of the Yahshua, faith in his blood, and those who escape and are sent to the nation to proclaim them Elohim's fame and his glory are doubtless 144,000 Israelites, godless servants of Elohim, the first fruits from the great harvest, the church of those whom they bring to the house of Yahweh, must therefore be the second fruit, the great multitude of the Revelation, 7:9, those who are gathered from all the nations after the seeding of the 144,000, after the cleansing of the church. So while the group of the Revelation 14:1-6 and Isaiah 66:19-20, the church purified, proclaimed unto all nations, the group of a chapter 10:11, the SDA denomination, proclaims only to many nations. And what is the everlasting gospel? The gospel that goes unto all nations. Revelation 7, saying with a loud voice, fear Elohim and give glory unto him, for the hour of his judgment is come, and worship him that made the heaven and earth and the sea and the fountains of waters. These godless servants of Elohim, you see, are founded to proclaim unto all human beings that the hour of his judgment, the judgment of the living, has come, and that the hour is the 11th hour, and I will have to upgrade that. The hour is the 12th hour. As I told you, the divisions and Adventists can only count to 11. Yahshua says there's 12 hours in a day, John 11:9. But still, the house of Israel still can only count to 11. They look upon the clock on the wall, and it says 11 o'clock. And it says, you see there? One more hour until sundown. And as soon as the sun goes down, it strikes 12 and it's all over with. So they say the 11th hour is your last hour until sundown. That's why we moved the numbers back one notch. That's why we now moved them back. 12 is in the place of 11 now, so when you come to 12, you know you got one more hour until sundown. Babylon the Great comes into power, Revelation 17, 3-5. Passes away, Revelation 18, 19. It is during this hour that all Elohim's people are called out of Babylon, the hour while she reigns over all nations. Thus are they rescued from the image beast decree, Revelation 13, 15. Taken out from among the nations that are ruled by the Babylon the Great, and are brought into the purified church of Elohim, where there is no sin and no fear of the Babylon's plagues falling upon them. Verses 8 to 11. And there followed another angel, saying, Babylon is fallen, that great city, because she made all nations drink of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. And the third angel followed them, saying with a loud voice, if any man worship the beast in his image, and receive his mark in his forehead or in his hand, the same shall drink of the wine of the wrath of the Elohim, which is poured out without the mixture, into the cup of his indignation, and he shall be tormented with the fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels, and in the presence of the Lamb, and the smoke and their torment ascend up forever and ever, and they have no rest day nor night, who worship the beast in his image, and whosoever see the mark of his name. Now, the complete fall of Babylon, that's our next subtitle. For these messages concerning Babylon the Great cannot in the fullest sense be proclaimed before Babylon comes into the being, nor before she actually sits on the scarlet colored beast, Revelation 17. But the message of the second angel did not reach its complete fulfillment in 1844. The churches then experienced a moral fall, and the consequence of the refusal of the light of the Advent message. But that fall was not complete. Not yet, however, can it be said that Babylon is fallen, because she made all nations drink of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. She has not yet made all nations do this. The work of the apostasy has not yet reached its culmination. The change is a progressive one, and the perfect fulfillment of the Revelation 14:8 is yet future. Great controversy. Page 389 and 390. Moreover, it is while Babylon rules that the whole earth is lightened with the glory of the angel. Chapter 18:1. Only the delivered ones escape the wrath of the Elohim. Verses 12 and 13. Here is the patience of the saints. Here are they that keep the commandments of Yahweh and the faith of Yahshua. And I heard a voice from heaven saying unto me, write, blessed are the dead which die in the Yahshua from henceforth. Yea, saith the Spirit, that they may rest from their labors, and their works do follow them. Blessed are the dead which die in the Yahshua from henceforth. That is, while the 144,000 stand on the Mount Zion, and from the time it is said, here is the patience of the saints, here are they that keep the commandments of Elohim and the faith of Yahshua. Death still reigns among the saints who are coming out of the Babylon, for the word henceforth denotes now on. From the time it is said, here is the patience of the saints. Verses 14 to 16, and I looked, and behold, a white cloud, and upon the cloud one sat like unto the Son of Man, having on his head a golden crown, and in his hand a sharp sickle. Another angel came out of the temple, crying with a loud voice unto him that sat on the cloud, thrust in thy sickle, and reap, for the time is come for thee to reap. For the harvest of the earth is ripe, and he had sat on the cloud, thrusting his sickle on the earth, and the earth was reaped. The two final harvests is our next subtitle. Here are indisputable words of the truth that again dispel the darkness which has been hovering over the subject of the harvest, for the separation of the wheat from the tares, of the good fish from the bad, of the gathering of the first and of the second fruits. For the Yahshua himself is here seen reaping the first fruits. Why himself? Because declares the Yahshua as he looked down to this time, the day of the vengeance is in mine heart, and the year of my redeemed has come, and I left and there was none to help me. and I wondered that there was none to uphold, therefore my own arm brought salvation unto me, and my fury it upheld me. And I will tread down the people in mine anger, and will make them drunk in my fury, and I will bring down their strength to the earth, Isaiah 63:4-6, and that certainly met its fulfillment in 2002 at Gilead Center. Chapter 17, verse 20. And another angel came out of the temple which is in the heaven, he also having a sharp sickle. Now that's actually Revelation 14:17 and verse 20. And another angel came out from the altar which had power over fire, and he cried the loud voice, a cry unto him that had the sharp sickle, saying, thrust in thy sharp sickle, and gather the clusters of the vine of the earth. Notice he said, gather the clusters. These are the good grapes. These are the remnant. For her grapes are fully ripe. Because he says, gather the clusters, for her grapes are fully ripe and ready to be harvested. And the angel thrust in his sickle into the earth and gathered the vine of the earth and cast it into the great wine press of the wrath of the Elohim. Why did he grab the vine and throw it in and do that? Because there was a lot of grapes that wasn't in clusters on those vines that hadn't come to fully ripe. But yet it was time for the harvest, and so they had to be left behind. They had some kind of a defect in them. And the winepress was trodden without the city, and blood came out of the winepress, even unto the horse bridles, by the space of 1,600 furlongs. Having thus rescued the first fruits, and they being his servants thereafter, they are the co-workers with the angels, who after the Yahshua reaps the earth, also reaps with a sharp sickle. In these verses, two classes are figuratively brought to view, the clusters and the vines. The one class, the clusters, is to be separated from the other, from the vines. For we cannot presume that the angel disobeyed the command, gather the clusters of the vine. The clusters, the good fruit, represent the saints, and the vines, along with the bad fruit left on them, must represent the wicked. Father and son, root and branch. These are cast into the great winepress of the wrath of the Elohim. For the enormous amount of the blood coming out of the winepress bespeaks that multitudes of the wicked are then to yield their lives for not having repented of their evil deeds before the gathering of the fruits is completed, at which time they all shall wail, for the harvest is past, the summer is ended, and we are not saved. Jeremiah 8:20. Here is proof positive that the harvest of both fruits come before the close of probation, before the plagues are poured out. Truly then, the harvest is in the end of the world, for it is terminated for. It is with the termination of the reign of the sin and destroying of the wicked, and safeguards the righteous. Unto me all these things stand out as clear as crystal, and I hope that I have not misstated myself if I have to, you tell me where so we'll read that again. To me all these things stand out as clear as crystal, and I hope that I have not misstated myself. If I have, you tell me where. Okay, that's the end of that chapter. We're going to go into part 3 of this here, track 16, with the subtitle, Inspiration's Way of Promoting Truth and the People's Way of Accepting It. It is surprisingly alarming to note how little thought has been given unto the method which inspiration has ever employed in the promoting of the truth and to the people's way of responding unto it. Since to neglect this part of our salvation is of the greater harm than any other neglect we may commit, it is very important that we are careful, that we carefully look into it so as to know what to watch for and what to expect if and when inspiration again begins to unroll the scroll of the prophecy, failing to respond to the inspiration's plea and failing to recognize that it is the voice of the spirit of the Elohim, would mean a sin against the Holy Spirit for which there is no forgiveness, Matthew 12:31-32. How essential then is it that we equip ourselves with the knowledge of this most important phenomenon of our salvation? In order to best grasp the picture, we should review the Spirit's work from the beginning until now. As the Spirit of the prophecy and the progression of the truth first manifested himself in Enoch, the seventh from Adam, we shall necessarily begin there, for the Enoch prophesied, "Behold, the Yahshua cometh with 10,000 of the saints," Jude 14. The next recorded manifestation of the Spirit of prophecy was in Noah, and later in Abraham, and Moses, John the Baptist, Yahshua, and the apostles. Next, the Spirit manifested himself by the unfolding of the 2300 days prophecy in the year of 1833, and again by the revealing of the commencement of the judgment hour for the dead. Following the judgment of the dead is manifestation of the judgment of the living. These manifestations of the Spirit of the prophecy that are manifestations of the progressive truth, so far number 9 times in all. Next, we are to note what each of these unfoldments were about. Enoch, we know, prophesied of the coming of the Yahshua with the 10,000 of the saints, which coming manifestly is similar unto what is now called the second coming of Yahshua, a coming which ends the wicked world and which commonly called the end of the world. Now, Enoch, he had his parallel with the Adventist movement in 1844. With William Miller, Enoch was a six-hour laborer in his day, and that's what William Miller was. He had his parallel. Noah had his parallel with the Seventh-day Adventist in 1844. Enoch, therefore, prophesied of the end of the world in that age, which came about by the Yahshua is flooding the old world, out of which 8 souls were saved by getting in the Noah's Ark. The end of the world in that day, therefore, is nothing less than a miniaturist picture of the end of the world that is yet to come. Thus Yahshua said, "But as it was in the days of Noah, so shall the end of the world be." There is therefore no need of the speculating what the end of the world will be like, for the type plainly demonstrates the likeness of it. Prophecy and fulfillment, that's our next subtitle. What do we then see in these two manifestations of the Spirit of the Truth? We see that of the Enoch is a forerunner of that of the Noah, that Enoch predicted the end of the world, and Noah prepared the way for it. Here at the outset, the Spirit of the prophecy has set a precedent in the way of the salvation, and we are in this study to see if it has been carried out up to our time. Then, too, the people's reaction also seems to have set a precedent of the unbelief and rebellion, not so much to the prophecy of the event, but to the fulfillment of it. For the Abraham, in whom the Spirit of the prophecy was next manifested, predicted and acted upon his own prediction, that he and his seed were to be sojourners in a strange land for a period of 430 years, after which they were to inherit the promised land. He and Lot, together with all their servants, left their father's house, and as far as we know, there was no opposition of any kind. This, but Abraham's announcement of the promise, must be remembered, was a prediction, not the fulfillment of it. 430 years later, as the time came for the fulfillment of the prophecy for the possession of the promised land, the opposition then began. The spirit of Elohim and the Moses was to lead the Israel of the Elohim into the promised land, and the devil and Pharaoh was there to oppose them going there. Having lost the battle in Egypt, The enemy remanifested himself in and among their own brethren during the entire journey in the wilderness and in the land itself, but the spirit's policy was the same as at the beginning, and the enemy's reaction through the people themselves was also manifested in the unbelief, rebellion, and opposition. Having done the stream of time, we come to the days of John the Baptist, in whom the Spirit announced that the King of Kings was to appear. And though there was scoffing and ridicule, there was no real opposition before the fulfillment of the John's prediction began to materialize. But when Yahshua began to work, then the conflict began not so much through the Roman governors, but through the church. The people who had for centuries waited for his arrival and who had spent millions of dollars for the proclaiming of the prophecies of him, the devil had so completely conquered the church that she went to work for him with no less zeal than did Pharaoh and his host. He was successfully using her to carry on his malicious work, although she was entirely unaware of it, although her own hands and garments were stained with the blood of the Lamb of the Elohim, with the blood of the apostles, even worse than she had them stained with the blood of the prophet, who years before did all to awaken her to the fact that the devil was controlling her. Thus far we have seen the spirit of prophecy invariably carrying his work first in the prophesying of the event, then in the fulfillment of it. For the enemy, though, did not do much to fight off the prophecies of the events, but spared nothing by which to defeat its fulfillment. That is, there was a word to prophecy, and a work to fulfill each prophesied event. But the opposition did not manifest itself in the work of the prophecy, but in the work of its fulfillment. Next, we are carried to the year of 1833, the time that the Spirit of Truth revealed that according to Daniel 8:14, the cleansing of the sanctuary was to begin in 1844. When all is not revealed, the First Day Advent movement, who priests announced the cleansing of the sanctuary, were not informed of what the cleansing itself was, so they thought it to be the end of the world. In this we see that the precedent which the Spirit of the Elohim established in the beginning, as we have seen thus far in this study, has been carried clear through. That is, though Enoch announced the end of the world in that day, he was not permitted to know and to declare that part which pertained to Noah's message, the flood, as it was the means of Elohim that the Elohim used in the bringing of the ancient world unto an end. Just what Enoch's own private conclusion of the end was, we do not know, but he must have had at least one. For the same case prevailed with Abraham. He was told that the promised land was to be his and to his seed after him, and that they were to sojourn for 430 years in a strange land. But as he did not know where and the means of their return, he too must have had his own private ideas and opinions fixed in his mind, but could never have, thought that they were to be in Egypt, and that a man by the name Moses was to lead them through the wilderness for 40 years before reaching the land. So whatever conclusions of his own he might have had, and however good and studious they might have been, they were not expressing the truth as they later proved to be. No, no more truth could they have been than William Miller's were of the cleansing of the sanctuary. Even Moses had to have some conclusions of his own, for he too did not know everything far in the advance. For example, he knew that Elohim had chosen him to lead Israel out of Egypt, but as unto the means, and the time he did not know. And what did he do about it? Nothing. Oh no, he concluded that the time had come for their deliverance, and therefore went to do something about it. He killed an Egyptian, then fled away. 40 years later, he discovered that his rash attempt of the deliverance was 40 years early, and that his means of the deliverance was not Elohim's means at all. having altogether dismissed the idea of his delivering the nation. Yahweh had a time of the convincing him that he was the one and that he could do so if he followed, but these are not the only ones he have had their private opinion shattered to pieces. There was John the Baptist, of whom Yahshua declared that there was no prophet greater than Matthew 11:9-11. Yet, not being told the whole truth, as no one has been, being part of Yahshua, whom he had as yet never met, was the King of Kings, John could not help but conclude that when Yahshua appears, he will doubtless establish the long-expected kingdom. But did he? So it was that when he told them the time had not yet come, even the apostles, after being taught by him for over 3 years, could not see but that he was then to set up his kingdom. Do we then conclude that they all were foolish prophets because they exercised their private judgments on things that had not yet been revealed? Of course not. For a false prophet is he who prophesies of a thing as a revelation from the Yahweh, although it be but his own opinion of the thing. For as we have already seen, no one knows the mind of the Elohim, and no one is big enough and wise enough to guess what Elohim's thought and intents are. Scriptures of no private interpretation. This is our next subtitle. Passing on in the stream of the time, we come to the time of William Miller. Since it was not his lot to proclaim the commencement of the judgment hour, he was not given light other than the termination of the 2300 days, as of Daniel 8:14. And as reason demanded that the meaning of the cleansing of the sanctuary be explained, he was compelled to exercise his own private judgment on it. As simple as it is for one to see that the cleansing of the sanctuary, the separation of the tares from among the wheat, in the records concerning the dead, could not possibly mean the world coming to an end. For the sanctuary could never mean world, yet he and all his associates were not rationalizing, unable to arrive at the exact truth, which in itself is sufficient to show that no scripture is of any private interpretation, but a work of the Spirit who indicted the scriptures. 1 Peter 1:20-21. Had Miller been given light to both announce the termination of the 2300 days and also the judgment of the hour, there would have been two messages to declare, one matured and one prematured. In the one period of the time, that is, one of the messages would have had to be declared ahead of time, something which inspiration never does. Doubly so in this case, for the first angel's message does not say, "Fear Elohim and give glory unto him, for the hour of his judgment shall come," but rather, "The hour of his judgment has come." This scripture in itself concretely shows that the truth of the judgment had to be declared, not before, but at the exact time it began, the judgment went in session, that his truth is in all respects meet in the due season, Matthew 24:45, not given too early or too late, that while we are taught truth, we are at the same time made to realize Elohim is visiting his people, making known unto them the time that they have come to. Moreover, Elohim invariably attests to his people in order to teach them that the truth is progressive and that no one can ever find the truth beyond what he reveals, and that no servant of his has ever been given knowledge of the whole truth, that it will take all of them together to bring forth the whole truth that he gives meat in the due season, that he does not feed his flock of the old stale food, but with the food fresh and up to date, that he leads them to green pastures in their season, that he accommodates them with the truth, especially adapted to meet their needs for the time, rather than having them spiritually starving while trying to survive on rehashed old worn out truths, and rather than to keep them blind of the signs of the times of the things that take place on the earth as well as of those that take place in heaven, it is His desire that we know what He would have us to do. His church is to be the light in the world, not especially to illuminate the past or the future, but rather the present. If the church in 1844 had known this precious lesson, there would have been no need of a disappointment. An inspiration would not have had to illustrate the incident by having John's belly become bitter after eating the book that was at the first to him as sweet as honey, Revelation 10:10. Moreover, as she then mistakenly thought her work was to be finished at the day that the 2300 prophetic days terminated, inspiration caused John to write, "John must prophesy again before many peoples and nations and tongues and kings," Revelation 10:11. Thus, she was enlightened and encouraged to rise and again proclaim what the Elohim has made known. Will the church heed inspiration? That's our next subtitle. Okay, let's go now with the next subtitle. Will the church heed inspiration? Having these precious lessons stand as monuments before her, will she now take heed to what the Spirit says, or will she at other times continue with her supposed wise judgment? Does she now see that many peoples, tongues, and kings means just that, or does she suppose it means all? Does she see that her commission with the judgment of the dead is limited to many, not all, that in order to go unto all nations she must be told so? Does she see that along with her next commission there must necessarily be another message, the judgment of the living, the everlasting gospel, with which she is to go unto all, unto every nation, and kindred, and tongue, and people, Revelation 14:6, will she now realize that the Elohim would not possibly reveal the judgment of the living together with the judgment of the dead? Will she continue to dwell in the vain imagination that she has had the whole truth and that she is now in the need of nothing more? For the Yahshua testified that she is in the need of everything, and is even wretched and miserable, and poor and blind and naked, Revelation 3:14-18. Will she believe the Yahshua? For these are the greatest questions for her to now answer. Moreover, this study proves that the truth the church could possibly have is only that which the Spirit of prophecy has brought throughout the year. That other so-called Bible truths that have come into the church are but theories, ideas, and opinions of the men, which, as we have already seen in these pages, have always proved to be foreign to the truth of Elohim, that they should be abandoned as soon as the truth on the subject is divinely revealed. Every one of us will have his hands full if he studies that which the Spirit of prophecy revealed at the unrolling of the scroll, without having to pry into the secret things of the Elohim. For the main lesson to be drawn from these concrete examples is that we as a Seventh-day Adventist have much to learn and much to unlearn, just as much or more than any who have gone before us. Okay, our next subtitle is, When Inspiration Exposes Our Private Theories, We Should Exchange Them for the Elohim's Truth. Now that the message of the judgment of the living is unfolding, and as truth exposes the theories, ideas, and opinions of which we have entertained as the truth of Elohim, the great question to be answered is, what are we doing about it? Are we humble enough and teachable enough so as to trade our error for the truth of Elohim? Or are we to hold unto them and become sinners against the Yahweh Spirit? We must not be like the Jews, the Romans, and the Protestants, who have, for the sake of their preconceived ideas, rejected the messages of the Elohim. We must rise above their unwise judgment, for they stand before us as precious examples. All of us know that they have not received from the throne of Elohim even one fresh spark of the light ever since they rejected the messages of the Elohim. Shall we then walk into hell in spite of the light that shines on our feet and that points the way into the kingdom of the eternal peace, security, and rest. Elohim forbid that we should play the fool. We all know that the 1833 movement had to endure the great disappointment. The book's turning bitter in its belly. And we also now know that we, as alleged sins, are wretched, miserable, poor, blind, and naked. And that we do not even know it. That if we do not now anoint our eyes with the eyesight of the Elohim, so that he does not uncover our shame, Revelation 3:18, if we do not do these, our bellies too will turn bitter. The next important thing to know now is this. No disappointment predicted here. Moreover, he said unto me, Son of man, eat that thou findest, eat this roll, and go speak unto the house of Israel. So I opened my mouth, and he caused me to eat that roll. And he said unto me, Son of man, cause thy belly to eat, and fill thy bowels with this roll that I give thee. Then did I eat it, and it was in my mouth as honey for sweetness, Ezekiel 3:1-3. Do not hastily conclude, brethren, that Ezekiel's prophecy is herein misapplied. Before you speak your mind, let us first look into it. Ezekiel wrote this prophecy 30 years after he went into the captivity. See Ezekiel 1:1. And at that time there was no house of Israel, or a house of Judah. Since this is so, then the book was not at all written in the behalf of the Elohim's ancient people, but in behalf of his people today, the day that the prophecies are unsealed to the house of Israel and Judah, the church of today. What is the Yahshua then saying unto us through the Ezekiel in the verses just quoted? Is he not revealing that though he has allowed disappointments to come in the times past, he is plainly now saying that there shall be none at this time, that the book eaten was as sweet as honey, that it did not turn bitter in the belly of the eater? All of this is for our encouragement, for our unwavering faith in the message of today, lest we be found wanting. Okay. Well, looks like this brings the end of our study in this track at the 11th hour by the Ben Roden. He's quoting V.T. Hollis at the Judgment of the Living at the 11th hour. This is track number 16. We're going to do a little review on some major points. In this track on page 16 now, the subtitle of Beginning of the Judgment of the Living, and I wrote in 2002 myself, it says, all these facts cause two things to stand out clearly. That with the culmination of the leopard-like beast, they had the composite of the four. The former beast period of the judgment of the dead ceases. And with the ascendancy of the and descendancy of the latter beast, the judgment of the living world begins and ends. Now, that's talking about the scarlet-colored beast in Revelation 17. So, we know 2002 was when the judgment for the dead ended. And so that was the end of the leopard-like beast that had the ten crowns, and Revelation 13 that had the ten crowns on the ten horns. They came out of the sea. That was a composite of Daniel's four beasts that he saw in vision. So the main point we want to make here is that in 2002, at the same time we had a presidential change. And we had a George Bush Jr. that became the President of the United States. I was shown that he's antitypical Nebuchadnezzar. And he's the one that represents the little two-horned beast that represents our country, there in Revelation 13, that came up in the earth. And the scarlet-colored beast also was seen in the wilderness here in the earth. So those two beasts, the number six and number seven beasts of Revelation 13 and 17, they came up in the earth. But the first five beasts came up from the sea, came up out of the sea. Okay, now, the point to be made is that the judgment of the dead ceases with Gilead Center, the third feeding pasture, the third step of the genuine movement of the seventh dead, the last of the fourth group laborers, and that was the congregation that I was with from 1970 to 2002, and so being involved in the beginning of the 11th hour, Mount Zion, the 11th hour church at Charlotte, and being responsible for helping to bring her to her end. It says that the revelation furthermore makes clear that the two-horned beast, which represents the United States, our high-ranking government of the United States, one having the power to perform wonders to even reshape the governmental principles of the nation and to bring them down to the level of the world that is represented by the leopard-like beast in its pre-winter state to the level of church and state rule. For the condition in which the beast blasphemed Elohim's name, his tabernacle, and them that dwell in heaven, Revelation 13:6, for inspiration so indicates in the words, and he doeth great wonders, so that he maketh fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men, and deceiveth them that dwell on the earth, by the means of those miracles which he had power to do in the sight of the beast, saying unto them that dwell on the earth, that they should make an image to the beast, which had their womb by a sword and did live. And he had power to give life unto the image of the beast. Who had this? The two-horned beast, George Bush presidency. He's the one that created that leopard-like beast in Revelation 17. And he had the power to give life to that image of the beast. How did he do that? By legislation through our Congress, legislating nearly $800 billion. Not 800 million, but 800 billion. And he gave half of that to Obama whenever he came into power and to launch his presidency. So he had power to give life unto the image of the beast, which Obama's in charge of today. The president that succeeded George Bush in 2009, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause that as many as would not worship the image of the beast should be killed. And he caused all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand or in their foreheads, and that no man might buy or sell save he that had the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. Revelation 13:13-17. Thus, the two-horned beast is the decree that anyone who fails to comply with his demand of the worship should be killed. This will come to pass while the woman rides the beast. This is Obama now. He's riding this beast. He's in charge of it. He represents him, the Muslim religion, which is all religions are represented by a woman. Through this symbolical prophecy is also seen that in an effort to perhaps clamp down on communism and to save the world system of religion, the churches will consolidate themselves and set up a world government, with the church being its brains and the state its power. The beast number, though, being in the sixes, 666, not in the biblical sevens, which denotes completeness, or all, shows an omission of a part of the world from the system of the worship. That is, some of the sects will refuse to comply with the beast decree. If none other, it is certain that the remnant, who keep the commandments of the Elohim and have the testimony of the Yahshua with the spirit of prophecy in their midst will stay out of it, and this is the very thing that will cause the beast to rigidly enforce its demands. That's the scarlet colored beast in Revelation 17. That's called Mystery Babylon, as well as the scarlet colored beast. It is also interesting to note that the two horned beast, the United States government, develops its super career during the end of the period. That is represented by the leopard light beast, and that was the end of the judgment of the dead, 2002, and rests its career during the end of the period that is represented by the scarlet colored beast. That's in the 12th hour when the scarlet colored beast shows up. And that's when this two horned beast rests his career. This is when he retires. When the scarlet colored beast shows up, and that has already taken place. 2009 is when the scarlet colored beast showed up. That's when this two horned beast that was led last but not least by George W. Bush Jr. as the President of the United States. When he turned the keys over to the scarlet colored beast with a woman riding the beast, then that's whenever his image came to an end. That's when his judgment of the dead, and that's when he came to his end as a government that's in charge, that's in power. Thus, the world of today with the world of yesterday and the world of tomorrow are all seen to stand before the judicial throne of the Elohim. Well, this truth is again seen from the fact that chapter 14, the next after chapter 13, brings to view the two harvests, the first and the second fruits, the living members of the church. And you'll find that all the way from Revelation 14, verse 14, on to the end of that chapter. Okay. So, this, really, we're at the end of our study for this hour. We're going to close out this series now with a song. Dusty Rose and Sandal Feet by Elijah Davis.
Judgment Day. Dusty Rose and no